In a world where action films are dumped in theaters and TV, dead on arrival.
I can't go on living this lie!
You need a hero.
Last time I trusted someone, I lost an eye.
You need a helper.
Hello, nothing to see here.
You need a healer.
That is affirmative.
You need...
We're on the air.
Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy.
Hey, everybody. Was that a great introduction? I'm here at the Stamford, Connecticut Library, the Ferguson Library, the awesome, with my friends and webmaster and co-host. On my left is?
Jen.
Do your full name.
Jen Hurler.
And you are?
No.
Mike is clapping. Yes.
I am running a newly created, in its infant stage, podcast and website, Animation Complex, found at animationcomplex.com.
And to my right?
Nico Mai. I'm one of the technical animators at Blue Sky Studio, also helping Jen with her podcast.
There we go. And in front is the wonderful webmaster, as always.
Hi!
Can you hear him?
Hi!
He's bottom of the tunnel. It's Mike Robb.
Hi!
Yeah, that's his. Well, you hear his voice. Anyway, welcome to the Autumn Wrap-Up. Autumn is the place where action movies go to die. And there's very few because the winter movie season starts basically at the beginning of November. So that's considered the Christmas season. So that's not the autumn. So the autumn is filled with movies that usually the studios don't have a lot of faith in. And my gosh, this episode is going to back that up. But we are going to go to the first released right after the summer season. It was kind of like on the edge of the summer autumn season. And that was Magnificent Seven. There's Mike clapping because now, Mike, you saw that?
Yes, I did.
And Nico, did you see that?
I have not.
Okay, and you, Jen, I know you haven't seen that.
No.
So here's the situation with Magnificent Seven. It is a Western, and that's interesting because the Western title is so powerful, it sort of supersedes action movie. It's a Western. A Western is different. A Western is not really considered an action movie. There are a lot of Westerns that are action movies and very clear action movies. In fact, the original Magnificent Seven, back in the 60s, I believe, is very clearly an action movie. And this new Magnificent Seven, directed by Antoine Fuqua, written by Richard Wenk and Nick Pizzolatto, is an action movie for sure. But it brings up the interesting issue of Western movies, which is the best Western movies, from my point of view, are the ones where there was a review of one of my favorite Western movies, Unforgiven. Clint Eastwood directed it and starred in it. I believe it got the Oscar. And again, all the accurate information will be on the website, Action Film Autopsy, under the supplemental section. But I believe it's a great movie, and a reviewer commented on it, reviewed it by saying he knew where every bullet went. And whenever I see a great Western, usually it's when you know where every bullet went. Westerns, the way the guns are in Westerns, they're not like automatic weapons in the modern action films. So you can go see an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie or any of those type of action films, and you have no idea where the bullets are. The bullets are coming a mile a minute. And when I was a kid, it was a lot of fun to watch like an old Roy Rogers movie, because those six shooters, they're called six shooters. It would be fun to count how many bullets came out of the six shooter, because it just kept going and going and going and going. But that's a different kind of movie. That's not an A movie. Magnificent Seven, of course, based on a Japanese film called Seven Samurai. And it's also based on the adaptation in the 60s by a director named John Sturges of the original Magnificent Seven. And this new Magnificent Seven, it's very clear that Antoine Fuqua really respected the original Magnificent Seven as well as a lot of great Westerns. There are echoes of the Sergio Leone Westerns, the Clint Eastwood Man with No Name Westerns, For a Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, and several other Sergio Leone Westerns. You can see a lot of that in the new Magnificent Seven. But it's also written by Richard Wenk, who we'll be talking about some more in this podcast for a later film we'll be dealing with, who wrote such films as 16 Blocks, the remake or the reboot of Mechanic with Jason Statham, and The Equalizer and Expendables 2. He's well known for making movies or writing movies that have virtually no suspense in them, because the main character knows exactly what he's doing and does it. And he's never really conflicted or never really put at a disadvantage. And I kind of dig that. I think that's pretty cool. Meanwhile, the stunts coordinator for Magnificent Seven was a guy named Jeffrey J. Dashnaw, who had his, I assume, brother Chad Dashaw, Dan Shaw, Dashaw, Dashnaw, that's his name, Chad Dashnaw, as his assistant stunt coordinator. And their brother Jake Dashnaw was also a stuntman. I'm guessing they're brothers. I'll look into that. Jeffrey Dashnaw has almost 200 stunting credits dating back to 1980. His first credit as coordinator was on the In the Heat of the Night TV series in 1988, and his notable coordinating stunt work since then includes Under Siege with Steven Seagal, Spy Kids, the whole Spy Kids series, Sin City, Grindhouse, Inglourious Basterds, Predators, Django Unchained, Fantastic Four, and The Hateful Eight. So he's been around. But the question is, what does a stuntman do on a Western, and what does the gun wrangler do on a Western? I looked up and down IMDb to find the gun wrangler on Magnificent Seven and couldn't find a name. I've worked with gun wranglers in the past, so I know they're on the set, and usually they supply the weapons and teach the actors how to use them. But I'm fairly certain they do not do anything else. In other words, they don't help choreograph the scene or work out the action with the guns. And here we have the Magnificent Seven. So I'm not sure who wound up telling the actors what was going to happen in the action sequences. Was it the writers? Was it the director? Was it the writer and directors? Was it the stunt people as well? It's hard to judge. All I know is that we had seven individual people in this movie. Here is another example of what I talked about on things like Pacific Rim and Ghostbusters. When you have a bunch of different characters, you have the opportunity to distinguish those characters from each other in how they act, how they think, what their motivations are, and most importantly, how they fight. And here we had several movies to call upon. We had Seven Samurai, we had the original Magnificent Seven. Denzel Washington is in this one playing the generic Chisholm was the name of his character, and he's representing the person who was originally played by Yul Brynner. Chris Pratt was playing basically the Steve McQueen role from the original. Ethan Hawke was playing two characters from the original Magnificent Seven, both the characters played by Robert Vaughn and Brad Dexter in the original. Robert Vaughn was a coward who has gotten into shell shock and didn't want a gunfight anymore, but was trying to keep that a secret from everybody. And Brad Dexter was the one who was sure that Yul Brynner was actually doing this, helping out this village in order to find a hidden cache of gold or some money. There was some money context. So Ethan Hawke's playing both those characters. Now, Byung-Hun Lee is a Korean who introduced in this movie playing a Chinese who was playing a Japanese fighter. In other words, he used Japanese fighting style. This was cool. This character is a Korean actor. He's a good Korean actor, but he's playing a Chinese character in the film. However, the Chinese character is fighting in a Japanese style, which is kind of cool because his character combines clearly the James Coburn character from the original, who was a knife man, and Toshiro Mifune in The Seven Samurai, who was a sword man. And so this character that Byung-Hun Lee is playing had blades as well as guns. And he had a whole bunch of blades that he would throw and he would slash Zatoichi style. Zatoichi is the blind swordsman of Japanese cinema and would hold the blade in a defensive position, not with the blade coming out from over your thumb, but down from under your pinky when he used it. And that was kind of cool. But again, they didn't, because we have basically, this is chop suey. I get very tired personally of Koreans playing Japanese. John Cho from Star Trek is playing Sulu, who's a Japanese character, but at least he's Asian. I mean, other than the whitewashing that goes on in modern films. So that was kind of cool. And interestingly, it also is very important in this particular instance, especially for these films, to not just mention the coordinator, the stunt coordinator, but actually mention the stunt man. Specifically, Byung-hun was his stunt double was Ryan Ryusaki, who is Japanese, who got his start basically with a Mortal Kombat series. And so that's kind of cool. So obviously during those action sequences, it was Ryan, not Byung, who was doing the action. So that was very important. Meanwhile, they also had a Mexican character who was very funny to me, because Manuel Garcia Rulfo subs for the character who was originally introduced in the original Magnificent Seven. It was very controversial at the time, or somewhat controversial, that they had a Mexican hero in the original Magnificent Seven, except the Mexican hero was played by Horst Buchholz, a German actor.
Classic Hollywood.
So Magnificent Seven starts pretty good. They have all these wonderful characters. Vincent D'Onofrio is my favorite character in the new Magnificent Seven. And I would say, if you want to see a really great scene, watch... Oh, yeah. Remember, this is a spoiler-full zone. Spoiler-full, not spoiler-free. By the way, out there, all my listeners, if you want to create a song... I'd love to have a spoiler-full song that we can play at the start of every episode so everyone will know that spoilers will be released. Vincent D'Onofrio has an amazing death scene. It's just basically a camera holds on his face for 90 seconds, or what seems like 90 seconds. And that is a lesson in acting that would cost 4 years at any major university. It's an amazing, it's the best thing in my mind in the whole movie. The movie starts well. They try to make distinctions between the characters, but once the fighting starts, you can see that they try. For instance, we have a knife guy, the rest guys are using guns, but I've been told that Antoine Fuqua's movies often fall apart. They start well, and then they kind of degenerate as the movie goes on. And Magnificent Seven is not really different. Things get, as the climax gets more and more extreme, and as the battle is waged between this small army of the villain and the Magnificent Seven, it gets muddier and muddier, and the behavior of the characters becomes less and less distinct, and it just becomes general, generic movement. For a while, you can tell what's going on, and then it stops making sense. It just becomes what I call empty movement. How did you feel, Mike, about the general action? Speak up.
The general action, I thought, hello, the general action was the microphone fell over. The general action I thought was interesting. What got me lost was that about a third of the way into the movie, I went, I've seen this before. Now, I'd not seen the other movies you talked about, but there was something familiar about it. All of a sudden, I took a vellum sheet of clear plastic and overlaid the movie Blazing Saddles to this movie, and 75% of the pieces fit.
That's very true. That's another.
Literally, yeah. Fit.
This is a Western homage almost as much as it is a distinct action film on its own.
And my unique question was, if you saw the movie, you know what the problem with the city was. Why didn't they just build a fake rock bridge?
Yes. That's a very good point, and that's pretty much puts it into perspective in terms of the Magnificent Seven. I will say that a good representation of how the movie falls apart is the fate of the Chris Pratt character, which originally what he intends to do in the film makes sense, but it is so agonized and ultimately so unbelievable how it plays out that it's just kind of, all right, you're just going to have to accept this as a decent autumn movie and not a really great one. But now let's go on for one of the reasons that I have Jen and Miko here, because shortly after seeing Magnificent Seven, we saw Storks.
Yay!
Directed by Nicholas Stoller and Doug Sweetland. Doug Sweetland was the animator on many Pixar movies and directed the short. Do you remember what he directed? Presto, which was about this rabbit trying to get fed during a magic act.
Yes.
Do you remember the movie that preceded? Because they always have a short in the Pixar movies before the main feature. What would its feature? Because that way you could probably see it on the DVD. It's a wonderful.
I don't remember.
It's a wonderful short.
Sweet.
Oh, it might have been Ratatouille.
It might have been Ratatouille.
So that was definitely, that was their, that they were testing their animation software on that one.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but the thing I noticed even at the time of seeing Presto originally was that it reminded me a lot of a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a Bugs Bunny cartoon where Bugs Bunny is waylaid by a magician
mm-hmm.
who's trying to get him to be the rabbit in the hat. And that's what Presto was. So it made a lot of sense that then Doug Sweetland, who directed Presto, was also a co-director on Storks. But it was also interesting that Storks was written and co-directed by Nicholas Stoller, who's a writer and director on things like The Carmichael Show, the two Muppets movies, the recent Muppets movies, Get Him to the Greek, and Forgetting Sarah Marshall. So he's a live-action director doing animation. And this is also a movie where they're trying to recreate the tradition of the Warner Brothers Looney Tunes. And as such, there's a lot of really wonderful choreography. The great thing about animation is you can utterly control your actor. So the timing that's needed in both comedy and action, you have as a director and as an animator total control of. There are some amazing choreographed moments in this movie, specifically with the baby machine, but
right.
most especially with the wolf pack.
With the wolf pack.
That becomes more and more complex and amazing for me personally. So I wanted to ask you guys who work at an animation company, specifically one of the last things that happens to, again, spoiler full, this wolf pack will turn itself into other things. They will, when their two leaders, their alpha dogs, suddenly say, wolf pack, come up, what is it, a sailing ship. A submarine. All sorts
suspension
of things.
Bridge.
Suspension bridge.
Which was the first thing that they come in and
yeah.
built.
They combine with each other. They team up. This huge pack turns into this thing. The thing that astonished me was the last thing, which I think was the van, the ambulance.
Yeah,
they become an ambulance with different wolves becoming the wheels and the back. How do you design a scene like that? Get closer to the mic.
Oh, that's a great question.
Thank you.
I think from a technical standpoint, it's definitely a very difficult thing to achieve, where having all of the animals, all of the wolves, come in into a van, but at the same time having different wolves also have their own animation, their eye movements, their breathing, and everything keeping them alive. So that was really amazing to see how they pulled that off.
Do you think one animator did the whole thing, or are different animators doing different wolves?
I think different animators did the main animation, how they transform. But in terms of when they transform, that's, I would assume it's already done by someone else, to have basically a slider where you can slide in those wolves into one pack. But in terms of different, like, wolves, while it's on a vehicle shape or a bridge shape, all of those wolves are done by, I would assume, multiple animators as like a background animation to keep the wolf alive.
This isn't like a normal crowd shot where like you can animate a number of different like walk cycles and motions, and you can kind of just like spread those out through like a crowd, like if they have a crowd in like a stadium or like just people walking down the street. Like this was crazy to me, just thinking about like how much design and thought had to go into it. Because it's not like, I don't know if we're describing it well, but it wasn't even like they combine into like one big wolf or like a shape.
No, it's
like
a bunch of individual wolves.
It reminded me a lot, if you've ever seen like videos of like ants in like the jungle when like they kind of form a raft. It was literally that. And then like they would take, in the submarine, it was especially funny because they would like kind of take turns rotating to catch their breath. And
yeah.
It was just like, yeah, it was like too personalized for each wolf for it to be like automated. Not that you could automate something that specific, but like it was crazy.
It was, I was fascinated. So each of those wolves were programmed and then they were combined?
I would assume that would be the case. They would each have their own animation to keep them feel alive. They all have variations of if each one make sure they're loop, so there's nothing pop in between. But in terms of the end, all the wolf coming all together, that has to be animated and I would say cheated in certain ways to make sure that everything fits together.
Yeah.
Because with a lot of animated films, sometimes the good way to cheat it, because of, it is an animated film where you have one motion coming into another object, but have a switch between assets, different animated assets that they use to cheat that
effect.
Are you
saying animated asses?
Assets.
Assets. Okay. I thought it was asses. I was going to say asses from now on. Well, you can see this is a little preview. We're going to have a whole episode on animated action eventually. But this was really, I'm going to be, when I see the video again, I'm going to be counting how many wolves. Because there were, what, dozens?
Easily two or three dozen.
But also when you watch how all the wolf combine into the van, just based on sheer amount of the volume of the wolf, there's no way they can fit. There's no way the van can be that size. It would have been, has to be a lot bigger. So that's the way when they cheat, they will have that sort of chaotic moment where everything comes together to form semi of that shape, and then they would do a swap in between.
Swap out the model.
Right.
Oh, you know, it's fascinating, too, because I'm certain that one of the reasons that that made my jaw drop was that I was certain that once they became the van, they did not stop moving. In other words, they didn't become the wall of the van and stop. They kept breathing. They kept looking around. Yeah. They kept interacting. Especially the wheels had to keep turning.
The wheels had to keep
turning. I feel so bad for them.
Yeah, and the turning wasn't one wolf. It was a couple of wolves.
It was a couple of wolves. Yeah. And the wolf are, every time one of them would hit the ground, which is great because they would feel pain.
Yeah.
They would react in pain.
Yeah.
So it feels so much more realistic and so much more funny when you see different wolves.
It was asking a lot of the audience, and I felt like they grounded it in a really good way. So like you understood that it was like preposterous, but like you just accepted it.
Yeah, because it feels like what Rick said that they're trying to do with the Looney Tunes style.
Right.
So a lot of times you set up a joke, you expect certain things, and they hit you with something completely
different.
They
go beyond.
So the first time when the wolf pack says, form a bridge, the first thing you think of is they're just going to stack all together,
line up,
and then they're going to cross. But instead of that, they form an actual suspension bridge.
Yeah.
And that
made
was...
made of their own bodies.
Made of all their bodies. And your mind was blown, and you just accept that that's the world that they're in, and that's how the wolf operates.
It's even beyond for me. It's the word isn't accepted. It's delighted.
Mm-hmm.
I was delighted by it. It harkened back to so many things. That was one of the things I liked about Magnificent Seven. That it paid tribute to what came before it. It just didn't pay it off. That to jump back into that, because that's going to be going an ongoing theme on this episode, is that they had the opportunity to individualize each person, individualize their weapon, and then individualize the way they used that weapon, and they kind of squandered it. They hinted at it with the blades, and they hinted at it with certain guns and certain rifles, but then they didn't follow through. So there was, as the movie went on, it went from being exciting to being time consuming. There was not a sense at the end where I went, that was great, the way I felt about Storks. There was a moment at the end where I went, okay, that was all right. It was not as bad as it could have been. But that's a terrible thing to say about a movie. Now, on that juncture, let's go to something else that we've all, not all of us, except for you, Jen, have seen at least a portion of, and that is the next on the hit parade, Luke Cage. We're going to jump to television because Luke Cage is a major situation. And also, I'm a little biased, or I was a little biased, because it was the fight coordination was done by James Liu. James Liu, I shouldn't say he's a friend of mine. We are friends. We are friendly. We have met each other many times over the years. He presented me with a Luke Cage stunt crew T-shirt when I had him as a guest for the third or fourth time at the San Diego Comic-Con Kung Fu Extravaganza. So I know James. I love James. He's amazing. He has been around. He's played 150 parts in movies. He's been a stuntman or a stunt coordinator in more than 100. He started way back in 1974 on the Kung Fu television show, which should have been Bruce Lee, but it was David Carradine. So he's amazing. So I came to Luke Cage with great hopes. It's produced by 24 people. It's directed by 12 people. It's written, created by a guy named Chio Hodari Coker. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. I'm sorry, sir, if I didn't. Who was involved with Ray Donovan, NCIS, Los Angeles, and Southland. And, of course, it's based on a Marvel comic book. And I was disappointed in both the show and the action, because the action was, it was gladiators. It was gladiator action. Mike, you've seen six episodes out of the, you've seen half of it, you think?
Nine
episodes. You've seen the whole thing.
I watched the whole thing.
Give me your feedback. You can talk specifically about the action, but you can also talk about the show, because the show is the character. It's a superhero show.
The action's biggest problem is it's not there. It is a show of talking.
That's right.
It is an incredible show of talking.
A lot of talking.
Right.
Now, if you had a superhero whose powers were mental, who was doing a Professor X type thing, mm-hmm. or whatever, then you can see where you could go into that.
Yeah, we'll see what Doctor Strange does,
right.
But I think Doctor Strange does a lot of action.
But we'll in see. This, we have a superhero whose powers are invulnerability and strength,
mm-hmm.
so that you'd think there'd be lots of action. They are almost afraid to show us that.
Yeah.
There were, in the last three episodes I saw, and I timed it, there were less than 7 minutes of anything going on,
yeah.
other than talking and music videos.
Yeah. Miko, we've seen the whole thing.
Right.
What did you think?
I feel like a good point on that action was that the way they structured the story, there wasn't any opposing force to Luke Cage till almost the last four episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So throughout the whole thing, he's always invincible.
Mm-hmm.
He would go in to you know, all these drug dealers or whatnot, and he would destroy the place
right.
without any opposing force
mm-hmm.
that can stop him. So I feel like a lot of actions are very straightforward. There's a lot of punching, a lot of throwing, not a lot of...
Throwing. That's my favorite thing.
There's not a lot of thing that really catched me.
Yeah. There are two things, folks, that you'll see me again and again respond to. One is somebody using their fists, and we'll hear about that in the upcoming films. But the other thing that makes me laugh so hard is throwing.
Right.
Throwing is the stupidest thing you can do.
Like throwing another character.
Yeah, just picking up a person and throwing them. And it's like, what's the point of that?
And Luke Cage does that
a lot.
A lot. Yeah. That's pretty much his main move.
Second only to Lee Majors in The $6 Million Man.
And the Hulk.
Because he rarely punched anyone.
In the TV show. Yeah.
One of the things is that he has superpower. He has super strength. So if we punch someone, he could have killed them.
Yeah.
So a lot of times he would rather throw them against the wall.
Yeah. And people would throw him in the wall.
Right.
You know, the superpowered people.
So in terms of the story, I talked to Jen a while back about this, since she hadn't seen it. There's two major villains in the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And the transition between the two of them was a bit...
Muddy.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
It was, there's always, the second villain's always there in the background. You always hear the name. It always comes up, but it never properly introduced him.
Right.
And but they did that so abruptly that the villain, I forgot what his name is.
We'll put it on the supplementals,
right.
guys. The main villain? Diamondback.
Diamondback, yeah. Yes. Diamondback's just started shooting him with the gun that could actually hurt Luke Cage. So it was so abrupt that all of a sudden we introduced this character and his connection with Luke Cage without having it properly done so in the beginning.
They have 13 episodes. The problem with all these Netflix Marvel TV shows for me is that they're basically 6 to 10 episode shows in a 13 episode package. They always waste so much time. And before I get into the action specifically, the climactic action between Diamondback and Luke Cage, mm-hmm. I do want to say that this is the worst defender. I mean, I thought Jessica Jones...
Yes.
Was three episodes too long, for sure. I mean, just the last three episodes,
right.
they were just killing time. But this one, Luke Cage especially, is, again, spoiler alert, this is a huge spoiler alert, is a circle jerk. At the end of the show, he's not only back to where he started, he's back before he started.
Before he started, yes.
The whole thing is just a gigantic waste of time. It's a setup for The Defenders, which is coming up, but... So what? And the final, the huge fight, the big climactic fight between Mike Coulter as Luke Cage and Eric LeRae Harvey as Diamondback might as well have been a peplum, a gladiator movie. All they do, or wrestlers, you know, WWE, they're just punching each other. And they're both taking it. Whenever, you know, one person will make a fist, pull back their arm, the other person will stand and wait for it.
Right.
And then take it full in the face or full in the body. In fact, they're in the middle of the street. Everybody's watching and yelling and rooting. In fact, it's funny because by the end of the scene, even the rooters are like getting bored because they're just kicking and punching each other, having no real effect on each other at all. Nobody's thinking. They're just pounding each other. And it was when I asked Jay, when we had James Liu on the panel at the San Diego Comic-Con Kung Fu Extravaganza, I asked him, what's the difference between doing Big Trouble in Little China, which he was the fight coordinator on, and this? He said, the trouble with this is finding him someone he could fight.
Right.
It's just kind of like, and what can you do at that point, especially since the director and the writers are insisting on brute strength and no brains? So that's Luke Cage for me in a nutshell. It was well written, well acted, well filmed, well stunted, but it was like people looking around to see how they could waste the 13 episodes.
Right. I feel like, especially with that saying though, how they build up the momentum of the show and everything towards the end, but the payback at the end, the resolution, like the fight,
there was no
wasn't
resolution.
Satisfying.
Yeah, nothing
at all.
Was. Yeah, nothing was.
He had this suit that he used to imitate.
That
Luke
looks
Cage.
Really stupid.
That looks very stupid. But they didn't fight. Yeah, like you said, they didn't fight. It was literally punching. They were supposed to be boxing partners,
right.
In their you know, flashbacks that they're showing that they're, you know, training together and become fighters and whatnot.
And they showed all those flashbacks, so you thought, and also what the Diamondback character was trying to teach Luke Cage.
Right.
So it would be a natural thing for Luke Cage in the final fight to have learned.
Right. And then to have a very good combat
right.
against each other instead of me punching you
and then you punching me.
Yeah. And then
at the
end.
And then just at the end it stops. Because not because anybody learned anything or figured out a way to do it. It stopped because his batteries ran out.
Pretty much.
His batteries just ran out. It's like a toy stopping. So that's Luke Cage. Now let's get to the last two, which I think only I have seen. Yes. The last two is The Accountant and Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. The Accountant was directed by Gavin O'Connor, who made a pretty good mixed martial art movie, which is saying a lot if it's coming from me, because you know what mixed martial arts is mixed with? Crap. Anyway, so it wasn't bad. It's written by Bill Dubuque, who also wrote The Judge, Robert Duvall, the guy who plays Iron Man. Robert Downey Jr. movie. Robert Downey Jr. and his father is a judge, and they have conflict, and they get into a legal thing. That's The Judge, written by the same guy who wrote The Accountant. The stunt coordinator is Fernando Chien, a.k.a. Chien Fu Nan, who is the fight coordinator for a short called Black Salt, which I saw recently at the Urban Action Showcase in New York, which will be happening again November 11th, 12th at November 12th specifically for the public at the AMC Empire 25 on 42nd Street in New York City, and you can meet all the guys from Black Salt as well as Big Trouble in Little China and The Last Dragon and all sorts of things. That's something to look up. The Urban Action Showcase. Anyway, prior to that, Fernando moved from Canada to Canada from Taiwan and was an actor in more films than he did stunts. Also helping with The Accountant was Sam Hargrave, who you may have heard on previous episodes because he was the stunt coordinator for the Suicide Squad retakes, Captain America Civil War, and Hunger Games, and other things. Now, here we go again. The Accountant is an inexplicable movie. About three-quarters of the way through, all the way to the end, I realized nothing in the movie made sense. Nothing. It just was this agony. There was an attempt to create a new heroic character played by Ben Affleck, the upcoming, our present and future Batman, who is an Asperger afflicted or Asperger dealing with, how do you term this nowadays in a politically correct manner? He has Asperger's, and he is an accountant for the worst gun runners in the world. So he has created a defensive situation where he can protect himself from these gun runners. He has created, his creation is kind of a cross between Dexter and John Wick. That's the way the action looks. And Affleck was very good in Superman versus Batman in terms of Batman fighting. And he's very good at fighting here, except the problem is that his whole character is based on his actions and reactions from Asperger's. Everything in his character is based on his Asperger's, except his fighting. This one seemed to be just like the simplest thing to do. Research Asperger's, ask experts in that situation, that whatever you want to call it, that affliction, that may not be politically correct, but whatever, and how a person with Asperger's would react to someone trying to punch him, or someone trying to kick him, or someone trying to grab him, or someone trying to shoot him, and design all the fights as an extension of his Asperger's, so suddenly the audience is interested, involved, excited, thrilled, and maybe even delighted, because it's all based on what we know of his character, because the whole rest of the movie is based on his Asperger's, except the fights. So it just perplexed me and disappointed me, even though several of the sequences were pretty nifty. But they weren't different. For all the difference in his fighting technique, he might as well not have had Asperger's. So what's the point of him having it at all? Now, add that to the fact that if you watch this movie, and it's not a terrible movie, it's got some amazing actors in it, but it is so incredibly nonsensical when you actually look at what it all means, and the ending is nonsense. But that's the issue there. Now, let's finally get to the pièce de résistance, the finale of this episode, and that is Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. And little did I know, now, okay, Jack Reacher, the original Jack Reacher, produced by Tom Cruise in partnership with Christopher McQuarrie, who wrote and directed the first Jack Reacher movie. Now, Christopher McQuarrie also worked on Edge of Tomorrow. It's called Edge of Tomorrow, right? The science fiction thing with Tom Cruise?
It has like seven names.
Yeah, it has seven names, you know. But he wrote and directed
that. That's the one most people hated at, though.
Right, but it's a great movie. It's a terrible title.
I love that movie.
It's a great movie. The movie's great. The title sucks.
Yeah. Right.
But, and he also did...
No, I won't even get into it.
No, go on.
Oh, no, I was going to say, well, because it was called, like, for a while it was called, and it was like the main thing on the poster was like Live,
Die, Repeat. Yeah.
But it was based on a book called All You Need Is Kill.
Right. Which so would have been a much better title.
Yeah, it would have been much more interesting, yeah.
Live, Die, Kill is too close to Groundhog Day with violence, but what are you going to do? But even so, it was a great movie, was not a great title, came after a bad Tom Cruise science fiction film, so nobody went to it, but it was a great movie. As was Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, written and directed by Christopher McQuarrie. So here, Jack Reacher... The original Jack Reacher, the great thing about the Jack Reacher character, and we are joined by Kai Connolly, Rob, Mike's wife, who, have you read the Jack Reacher books?
Not all of them.
But you've read some of them.
I read the first two.
Did you read Never Go Back?
I don't remember. The names are too many.
Okay. Well, that's true. But the thing about Jack Reacher...
Wait, sorry. Who wrote them again?
Lee Childs.
Oh, okay. Because I'm like, it's one of those guys who just churns out books, like, so often.
But you know what, though? He's, for an author of that type of a writer, mm-hmm. That wasn't even English, by the way, an author, that type of writer. It's a new phrase now.
Yeah.
He's pretty good. It's not that Danielle Steele,
right.
Mm-hmm. Once you've read the first five, you've read them all.
But also, the difference with Jack Reacher is that he's independent. He's pragmatic and he's honest.
Yes.
So you can't use cliches against him because he'll knock him down. And in the first movie, that's exactly what happens. Somebody threatens the girl that he's sort of nominally involved with and he goes, whatever. And just keeps going. He said, you kill her if you want to. I just met her. You know, and that's the awesome thing about him. And also in the first movie, he fought in character. In other words, what things that delighted me in the first movie is that he would almost immediately go for one of two things, your eye or your balls. And that was awesome, because that's the way a real effective writer actually does it. He goes for the weak parts. He's not going to try to prove himself by making a fist and punching you in the jaw or picking you up and throwing you.
That fits the character really well in the
right.
first one.
Yes.
He puts his thumb in your eye if he's at a disadvantage. And if he's not, he's just going to kick you in the back of the knee, break your leg, and that's going to bring you down, make you helpless, or he's going to kick you in or punch you in the balls.
Well, the character is written exactly that way. So
right.
if you're going to change that, or if he's going to, in book, 25, start yeah. making him a wuss, then
well,
you could just kill the character.
That's exactly what happened
in movie two.
Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. It turns out that the last three words of the title is not the title, subtitle, it's a warning.
That's a shame.
Because while it's produced by Tom Cruise, starring Tom Cruise, produced by McQuarrie, it is directed and co-written by Edward Zwick, the man who's most responsible for the 80s television show 30-something. Also, he made Glory, Legends of the Fall, Courage Under Fire, The Last Samurai, Love and Other Drugs. He's got his heart on his sleeve. If you see any of his movies, you see he has his heart on his sleeve. It's also co-written by his partner, Marshall Herskovitz, and co-written by the guy we mentioned earlier, Richard Wenk, who also wrote 16 Blocks, Mechanic, Expendables 2, The Equalizer. So I was expecting this to be just similar to the original Jack Reacher, in that we had a heroic, pragmatic hero who would turn all the cliches on their heads. Nope.
That's too bad.
Because Mr. Zwick has decided to make him, rather than smart and pragmatic, make him stupid and petulant. And the fighting goes right with him. The movie opens with the scene that you may have seen in the previews, of Jack Reacher inside a diner with this corrupt cop arresting him, and Reacher saying, two things are going to happen. The phone is going to ring, and then you're going to be taken out with the handcuffs. But guess what? Prior to that, there was a fight that they don't show of him defeating the sheriff's helpers, his mob, his thugs, his whatever they're called. And we don't see that fight. All we see, the first shot of Jack Reacher in this movie, are of his right hand. And the shot makes a big deal out of showing how his knuckles are bloodied and broken. And I literally, in the movie theater, threw up my hands. Because Jack Reacher never would have used his fists in the first movie, because as any good fighter knows, the fists are the stupidest thing, as Jack Reacher in the first movie knew. The fists are the stupidest thing to use if you want to be an effective winner of a fight. You do not punch people in the hardest parts of their body. You go for the balls or you go for their eyes. You do not go for their jaws with your knuckles. That's the first shot of him in the film. And the rest of the movie, it's as if he completely forgot who he was. It's as if he was, I don't know, given a drug that just cut him off. The first movie specialized with Christopher Quarrie would always shoot Tom Cruise as Jack Reacher. Whenever he shot his face, Reacher, you could see clearly, was always thinking about what he's going to do, how he's going to plan ahead, how he's going to figure things out, how he's going to prevent problems, because he wanted to be pragmatic and win. In this movie, whenever they shot his face, you could see he wasn't thinking. You can see him trying to think. There were things in this movie, if it had been the first film, that he would have instantly known what was going to happen and thought ahead and planned for it. Not here.
So I have a question.
Yes.
Since I'm late to the party, maybe
yes.
you addressed it,
no.
But maybe we can end with this. If it wasn't Jack Reacher, how was the movie?
It was still stupid.
That too. Like, could you just generic like action star?
Yeah. Well, that's the point. Generic. Yeah. I'm not interested, as I've said on the show before, and I will say again, I'm not interested in generic action. The metaphor I want to use now, and I plan to use in the future, is what if you were seeing a drama or a comedy, and suddenly two characters set up a confrontation, verbal confrontation with each other. And then for the next 3 to 8 minutes, all any of the characters said to each other was blah, 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 blah. That's what these empty movement fight scenes seem like to me. It is a waste of time. It is pointless. It fills time. And what Zwick did here with his crew, let me tell you who else. Let's see. It was Robert Alonso was the stunt coordinator and did additional photography. He became famous for Deadpool. Scott Armstrong was the assistant stunt coordinator, who's the son of Vic Armstrong, one of the most magnificent stunt coordinators in the history of film,
cousin
who I've mentioned
Stretch.
Before. he could have been, considering what he's done. Wade Eastwood, who, as far as I can tell, is not related to Clint, was the stunt coordinator. He also worked with Tom Cruise on Rogue Nation and Edge of Tomorrow. And Wolfgang Stegeman, Stegemann, was the fight team and fight trainer, who also has been working fairly exclusively with Tom Cruise, although he also did Inferno, the new Tom Hanks movie, and he's doing the next Mummy movie starring Tom Cruise. And the big climactic moment in Never Go Back is a fight with a character who I think is called the Hunter. You'll see on the website, I'll tell you his actual name. He's played by a guy named Patrick Huizinger. And Christopher Gordon, who started stunting in 2000, was Tom Cruise's stunt double, with Craig Hennison, who started in 2010 with Deadpool and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., was Huizinger's stunt person. So they were the guys who were doing most of the fights. And it seemed like in order to make the villain, the Hunter guy, into a formidable foe to Jack Reacher, they gave all of Jack Reacher's, especially leg techniques of kicking the back of the knee and the shin, to the villain, while the crew seemed to have completely forgotten about it. The whole movie is about Jack Reacher may have finding an illegitimate daughter. But I tell you, the dialogue is agonizingly awful. Jack Reacher is simply not Jack Reacher. He's like a pod person of Jack Reacher. And as such, extremely disappointing. Now, I actually did try to answer your questions. I did try to figure out how I would feel about this movie had it not been a Jack Reacher movie. It still would have been disappointing. Now, I'm trying to imagine how it would have been had I not seen Edge of Tomorrow or Rogue Nation. And it's even more disappointing. But not having seen any of those and just seeing this, it still would have been, I'm sure I would have felt it was as painfully stupid and disappointing and unsatisfying as it is now. Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. Well, that's the autumn for you. Look forward next week to probably another interview. Then we're going to be starting with the Christmas stuff, which is going to be awesome. And then we're going to be planning all sorts of stuff. So thanks for listening, everybody. And as usual, remember what I always say. Use your blinkers, jackass.
Okay, break it up. Break it up. For now.
You don't give up, do you?
Listen in next time for more Film Fun, Frenzy, and Friends. Until then,
give me a real fight.
Check out actionfilmautopsy.com, where the excitement never ends.